to help through three. The other thing about the cold of the winter was that when I was there, which was in the winter of 51-52, all our units had been issued with proper winter equipment, very good boots, windproof smocks and trousers and string vests, and we had long john underwear, and everything was, one was very adequately equipped. But in the previous winter, which was before I went there, I think that the troops had arrived there with very inadequate clothing for the conditions that obtained in the winter. Nobody expected or realized just how bitter and unpleasant it could be. 30 degrees of frost on a bright sunny day doesn't worry one particularly. If you've got a flannel shirt on and a nice heavy sweater, you're quite comfortable. You get a 1 mile an hour wind with that sort of conditions and it literally shreds you. It made a tremendous difference. And people in an observation post, which hopefully would be dug in, they're looking through a small gap out over enemy lines. Everything is white with snow, which doesn't help the eyes anyway, but you also, unless you're lucky, you've got this screaming wind coming through a small aperture. And you just sort of can't cope with your observation for very long. It's something which slows people up generally, I feel. When they weren't actually engaged in any operations or anything like that, again, you've got soldiers living in a hole in the ground. They need to keep warm. It's not as I've said, I think, not a lot of wood about, and what wood had been about had mostly been burnt or used for building holes or shoring up dugouts and things like that in the previous year, so that the next best thing was petrol. Well, petrol's a very explosive commodity, and yet everywhere you went there were people living in holes in the ground with perhaps the base of a cartridge case which was spent, filled with sand, and then petrol poured on it, and that was your means of heating and cooking, burning raw petrol in an open tin or that sort of thing. If you were luckier and you were further back in administration or at headquarters or something, you would be in a tent. The tents were very good, but again, temperatures were low, but they were fitted with space heaters, and the space heater consisted of a steel drum, 2.5 feet high by about 18 inches in diameter, which had a cup inside it and a chimney, and was fed from a jerry can outside your tent through a pipe, which went through an ordinary Jeep carburetor, which controlled its flow into the space heater, and was burning just raw petrol. And if you had your carburetor turned up, it could be so hot that you could literally see through the metal to the inside of the drum. And these were extremely efficient, but they also had an outlet pipe, so that if the carburetor overflowed, the petrol could drain off out of it and go outside. If you were desperate and happened to have only half the equipment, people were inclined to say, well, you know, we'll be careful with this, but we're not going to go without some form of heating. And I think there were a fair number of pretty horrific accidents with naked petrol being burnt and fires as a result. But otherwise, for instance, on one of our gun positions, we had a petrol dump in 40-gallon drums a few yards away from everything else, and as was only to be expected, quite a amount of spillage on the ground, which rather worried me. I thought, well, if somebody drops a match or something on this petrol-soaked ground, we're going to have an explosive situation with all these other 40-gallon drums. So at great expense of labour, we shifted them all,
yes,
and built a small fire on this petrol-soaked ground in order to sort of eliminate the possibility of fire. But the temperature was so low, and presumably petrol under those circumstances was so lacking in volatility, that nothing happened at all. We couldn't burn the ground, we couldn't even burn the petrol. So it was, that's the sort of thing that happened with the temperature. The other thing that, of course, under very cold conditions like that, although you had adequate clothing and sleeping accommodation and so on, soldiers in the front line of that sort of area, living in very primitive conditions, very often in trenches that were taken over from any other unit or any other nationality, with due respect to the other people, and probably not always, we were not always entirely blameless, there was a certain amount of livestock around inside the trenches, and also certain people were rather inclined to say, well, the cold freezes things so quickly, there's no need to go outside the tent to relieve yourself. You can wait till the morning and throw it away as a brick. It's solid and sterile, it doesn't matter. Which is all very well until the spring comes, and then all of a sudden the trenches become quite uninhabitable and you can't cope with the things at all.
What kind of livestock?
Well, lice and fleas and, I mean, that sort of livestock, you know, sort of animal livestock, if you like to put it that way.
Cockroaches?
No, didn't see many of those. Cockroaches, any time I saw those, were on the ship.
What's happened to you after Operation Commando?
Well, we really, it was shortly after that that we were amalgamated into a regiment as such, having been very independent as, we were independent batteries, and then the troops of those batteries were assigned to battalions to whom we sort of attached ourselves very much and sort of became even more independent. And as part of the formation of the Commonwealth Division, a unit known as the 61st Light Regiment was formed, which embraced the three mortar batteries, a battery of self-propelled Bofa guns, and a location battery, which was based at headquarters artillery. And they all came under the heading of the 61st Light Regiment. And at about this time, I was transferred to Headquarters Royal Artillery as their intelligence officer, which is a sort of junior, or the most junior staff appointment, I suppose, there. I lived at divisional headquarters in the artillery section. I did my stint as duty officer in the divisional command post, which meant that if you were you sat in a command vehicle with a wireless net which covered all the artillery in the division and also had lines to the core artillery, which was an American unit, of course, our parent unit. The Commonwealth Division was only one division in the American 8th Army, in effect. And from this wireless point, if a battle brewed on our particular front and somebody called for fire in a particular area with a map reference, it came through via their wireless network into the divisional command post. And according to the situation there, if they wanted really heavy fire and was something beyond the capability of that particular artillery unit, which may be four guns or eight guns or what have you, we could, if necessary, bring to bear the entire weight of the divisional artillery, and if necessary, and they would were prepared to support us, the corps artillery as well, all through the one person at the divisional headquarters, which was a system of wireless communication and fire control built up in the Second World War, which is nobody has ever, I don't think, ever quite equaled, and which was a source of continual amazement to the American Army in particular, was the speed at which you could bring down a concentrated target of perhaps 200 guns onto one area in a matter of 3-4 minutes. This happened on one or two occasions when we were there. A firefight, an attack would brew up on a particular time at night. You would have the complete map of your divisional front in front of you, with every single platoon and company position marked on it. You would have SOS fire tasks already plotted and fired in on that, with code names. A person would ring up from, or come through on the wireless from a particular position and say that they were attack or troop formation was being built up, an attack was coming on at such and such a point, and could they have fire on that? And straight away you could order over that wireless by return the code number of that defensive fire, and all the units that it, you addressed came in on it, and down came the fire immediately. It was a very cheering response as far as the person being attacked was concerned.
Within seconds?
Oh, yes. Just like that. It was purely a wireless disciplinary thing with set calls. A mic target was a regimental target. They'd just come up on the phone, they'd say, "Mic target, mic target, mic target." And you'd have out perhaps five OPs in that regiment. And that would go to the regimental headquarters. And the regimental adjutant would probably be the man there. And he'd just repeat it, "Mic target, map reference, all units engage, scale three," which meant three rounds per gun, "fire." And they'd all fire, bang, just like that. If it was a case of them to get effect, he would give an order of fire by order. He'd give out all that information, and it'd be fire by order, and they would come straight back as soon as they were ready. You know, George ready, Nan ready, or what have you. And as soon as he got them all ready, he'd say fire, and they'd all fire at the same time, so that you got the maximum effect of all those shells dropping on the target at the same moment, instead of it being a trickle and a scatter.
Can you tell me about what your intelligence officer work involved, precisely?
Well, basically, I was a duty officer at the command, headquarters RA command, that was one thing. I was also, as much as anything, involved with fire plans and harassing fire at night, so that you could say, righto, well now we're going to have a firing program throughout the divisional artillery for tonight. That map reference there is a place that we know, we see vehicles going through. It'll be a supply point coming through. We'll say, righto, well, at such and such a time, such and such a unit, we'll engage that with, we'll say, four rounds gunfire, bang, finish. There's another one there, it's a funny area there. We'd like a couple of guns firing at intermittent intervals, not more than, not longer than 20-minute intervals, but any time they like, from between 4 o'clock in the morning until 5. These are harassing fire tasks, just making life bloody difficult on the other side. On the map here, there's a road junction, there's three tracks come together. We'll give that a plaster at various intervals during the night, these sort of things. And of course they were changed night by night, so nobody knew sort of when it was happening. Basically, to make life bloody difficult on the other side. Chances of ever killing anybody or doing anything are pretty remote, but it all helps, the jumpiness and this sort of thing. We were also involved with the other business of the airstrikes. If there was a certain gun position that we knew, and it seemed to be a pretty static one, and it was causing a lot of problems, we'd organise with, the Americans had some 8-inch howitzer battalions, which were a fantastic gun, throwing a very big shell, but it was extremely accurate because it was a high trajectory gun. It had a very small zone. You appreciate that a high velocity weapon firing below 45 degrees, it makes its shell falls in a pattern like a long oval, whereas a high trajectory weapon, the nearer it is to you, because it's going right up and coming straight down, it has a very small area in which it falls. and is a very useful gun for destroying the opposition. And so we'd organise perhaps to have an 8-inch howitzer at our disposal purely for a destruction shoot for tomorrow or something, and an OP of such and such a regiment would do he'd do the shoot, do the observation on it and the control of that fire, and it again would come back through that wireless network to wherever that 8-inch battalion happened to be, probably somewhere out in the flank of the neighbouring division, because we didn't, or in Khor Artillery area. Airstrikes were organised again from this point of view, a particular area, and they might sort of think, well, we think that's, from all the digging that's going on in that area, we think that's a Chinese command post. We'd like to put in a strike on that and destroy that. And they get lightnings or typhoons or the... we had the British Navy had a carrier out there, the Glory, and they used to fly close support strikes, sorties, right through, round the clock during daylight. I mean, they were at sea, but they'd fly off and they'd come in on the ground controller who would, again, this would all be laid on, you know, and he'd be in position and say, right, oh, well, we've got this tied up, these flights are coming in, we've got four typhoons or what have you coming in at such and such a time. They've had their target description, we know what their armament is, we'll talk them in on the ground, but they've already been briefed in the air. And they would come on and pick up on the network, and they'd then be guided in, and you would give corrections onto the target as to how they were, you know, whether they were hitting it properly or not. And they would come in one at a time, low ground strike, firing rockets or napalm or whatever it happened to be, and until they'd used up all their armament, and then they'd go back and go back to the carrier, and there'd be a debrief, and we would send a report back, and the two things presumably would eventually meet. But there was quite a lot of that was quite a thing to see a close support strike. It was good backup.
Which did you personally prefer, your job at headquarters or the earlier job with the mortar?
Well, they're quite different. To a certain extent, I enjoyed it with being at headquarters, because I had to liaise with the flanking divisions and also Khor. And it was always interesting to go to see other people, especially of different nationalities, see their organisation. You went there as a visitor, and you were nicely looked after and perhaps had lunch with them and shown their organisation and discussed various things. The liaison side always suited my particular personality to a certain extent. The guns were great fun because they were highly mobile. You could do all sorts of things with them. It was your own little command. You were only 40 strong maximum of everything. And it was very much probably one of the best commands you could possibly have at any stage in military life, because you'd know everybody there, and they were your family, and you were responsible for them and for their guns and for everything about them. And to a certain extent you could be a bit bloody minded and say, well, I don't want such and such a thing to happen, or to lose Gunner Bloggs because of X, Y and Z to your parent superior, as it were. And from that point of view, it was a very good thing to have. And you had an independence, not only that you were away from them. I mean, we had one position where we were near the battalion headquarters, our gun position, and we could also, it was high up, and we had a marvellous view, and we could see a long way, and we could fire our guns from the gun position, which is unusual. Normally you have your guns under cover here, and you go to an OP there, and you're firing indirect over the hill. Well, there was a valley ran out from our gun position towards the Chinese, and it had three re-entrants which ran off parallel to the right. So we decided that we would try and get a bit more range, and we went out beyond our infantry lines and ran down this track before first light. We put our mortars in the trucks, so that they were just trucks as far as they were concerned, and then we put them into action in these wooded re-entrants, which were quite well covered. And then we'd do fire tasks during the day there, from there, which gave us a lot more range, then come out again after dark again at night. Well, we did it the first couple of times. We had quite a lot of fun out of it, and it worked quite well. And then one of the other troops decided they'd go and have a go, and they went out, and they weren't from our position. They came through our position and went out down the same valley and did the same sort of thing. And presumably the Chinese had picked up the answer by then, and they fired a ripple of rockets, which is the first time I'd ever heard the things before. I'd heard of them, but I'd never actually experienced them. And they were rather like I was saying earlier on, the American style of thing, but I'm not helicopter born. And they'd got this bank of rockets, which presumably were pretty well accurately surveyed in, and they fired a ripple consisting of about 120 rounds just going off one after the other. It was not a bang, 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 bang like that until they'd finished the rack. And they all came in or around this particular mortar position and didn't do any harm, really. I think there was the troop commander got some plastic bits in his face or something like that, but that was about all. But a very frightening thing, because each one is the equivalent, really, of a 5-inch shell. But not terribly accurate, but a big blanket weapon, you know. So I didn't do any more of that after that.
Now, from what you've been describing, the Allied forces, the UN forces, had so much material in comparison with the Chinese. Mm. I know you've talked about the quality of the Chinese infantrymen. In a way, it's surprising that the UN forces didn't do better with their overwhelming material superiority. Did you feel that at the time?
Yes, I think you come down to the basic thing that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how good your material is. If you've got a well-trained man with a weapon that will kill in an area where the conditions are very primitive, and you have a lot of those people, and you're prepared to sacrifice them, you can balance up until you run out of men, presumably, against a mechanical backup, because a mechanical backup sucks in and absorbs a hell of a lot of manpower. I think, I forget what the proportions are, but for every man who's in the field with a rifle and bayonet, I think it takes something like 35 at the back to put him there. Mechanical things take a hell of a lot of maintenance, with tanks breaking down and tracks stripping, vehicles, whereas old blogs can go on walking all day long. And if you've got a coolie trained to supply him with, or mules, or what have you, and you're going to, the only way in which you can actually hold the ground is by manpower, and manpower is the only thing. You can't hold ground with a tank or with guns or anything else. It's old blog sitting on the ground there, denying it to the opposition. And I think to a certain extent it balances out. They had the manpower, and of course we were never, MacArthur, it was the reason he wanted to go across the Yalu River to the Chinese border, because it was an endless source of supply. The manpower kept coming over the border, the supplies kept coming over the border, and until you can actually defeat the source of that, you're never going to win. And this was basically where he fell out with Truman, and it was understandable, but he was wrong, I quite agree, but it was a perfectly logical explanation.
You've described one or two personally frightening experiences, like the Chinese rocket attack just now, but I get the impression from what you've said that these frightening or dangerous incidents were very rare for you.
Well, they were from my point of view. I was fortunate with it. The two chaps that I spoke of who went out with me originally, who were both killed, one of them went out as a forward observation officer during Operation Commando. He was with a company commander. He was a chap who'd served in the Second World War, so it was not his first time. But they were going through cops or something, and they were going over ground which had been held by both Korean troops and Chinese troops. And it was littered with all sorts of funny booby traps and tripwires and God knows what. And somebody, whilst there, although somebody, a lot of people had gone on ahead of him, the group that he was with, somebody felt themselves kick a wire. And they shouted, and everybody hit the deck very quickly. And he, not being accustomed to it, didn't hit it fast enough. And there was a grenade in a tree, and it just blew his head off. I mean, that is a particular incident that, again, I heard it second hand. The other chap also had served in the Second World War, and he was doing a forward observation officer on the big hill that I was talking about, 355. And he and his assistant were in a little, tiny little slip trench on the front of the hill. And they were there was a fairly heavy sort of strafing going on. They were being mortared and shelled and what have you. And as all that you can do under those conditions is to sort of get down the bottom of the hole and sort of hope for the best. That's that. And the idea being that the smaller a slip trench is and the deeper and the more sheer the sides are, the more chances you have of survival, which is fair enough. Unfortunately, a mortar bomb dropped straight in the hole and just sort of blew the two of them to pieces. There was just nothing there. But that was that's one of those particular incidents. I was never actually involved in a platoon or in a company when it was actually under attack. I was either at the gun position or, I was adjoining, perhaps watching from another company that wasn't being attacked. I was never actually personally attacked, put it that way, except by shell fire.
You may think of it later.
Yes.
If I can ask you another question.
Yes.
About you talked about your contact with the Allied forces.
Yes.
What impression of their efficiency and morale did you get?
Obviously it was basically, let's face it, I was attached to the 3rd Australian Battalion at one time, and they were... their 2nd Battalion, I think, that was sent out there, and they described themselves as an Australian battalion staffed by a lot of bloody pommies, because they'd at that time had recruited a lot of soldiers after the Second World War to go out to Australia, and a lot of them ended up in the Australian Army, so that about half of this battalion were in fact ex-British soldiers who'd gone out to Australia. And of course they were armed with the old 14-18 rifle, the short magazine Lee Enfield with the long 18-inch bayonet. And they were a real sort of rough and ready, very, very cheerful crowd, and very efficient, I thought, in their own way, but an entirely different approach to life. I mean, everybody was Christian names from top to bottom, and they had a pretty good record out there. When there was a nonsense, for instance, like this business of stone throwing or just general sort of nerve warfare going on round a perimeter or anything like that, or a company perimeter or platoon perimeter or something, their great cry was just to sit in their foxholes with those horrible long 18-inch bayonets fixed. And they sat there with their rifles between their knees, and all you could see if it was a moonlight night were these bayonets sticking out the hole.